McGinnis. I'm a grateful and enthusiastic member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. And I am a miracle. No doubt about that. I want to thank Susie for inviting me to share today. You know, there was some changes about the chairperson, but I'm so glad they didn't change who the luncheon speaker was going to be. So I'm grateful for that, to be here. I'm supposed to share what it was like, how I got here, and how my life is today. And I am a perfectionistic, obsessive, anxiety-ridden, people-pleaser person. And so I want my talk to be 20 minutes of what it was like, 20 minutes of how I got here, and 20 minutes of what's my life today. But I'm going to be my own miracle today. And I'm just going to do whatever God says. And if I have like 18 or 19 minutes in either section, it's okay. So I was born and raised in New York City into a large, extended Puerto Rican family, hence the accent. I was the oldest of four children, so that means I'm bossy and controlling and love every minute of it. My family was full of aunts and cousins, and all the family members lived in a tenement. I was not aware at all about alcoholism, only the local bum king who used to drink some beers in a paper bag. That was my idea of alcoholism. I had no idea that there was alcoholism, drug addiction, mental illness, a whole bunch of stuff in my family, until I came to Al-Anon 24 years ago in July. I came because my former husband's drinking bothered me, and mostly his behavior bothered me. I didn't mind that he drank because it was a periodic drinker, and I quite didn't know, you know, what it was until I read that list of the 20 questions, and then I assessed him. You're an alcoholic. So when I came here to Al-Anon, then I discovered, holy smokes, I'm the great-granddaughter of an alcoholic, a granddaughter of an alcoholic, a daughter of an alcoholic addict, a sibling of an alcoholic addict. I mean, they were all over the place. And I was only able to identify that when I got here. As a student, I was a perfect child. I was that little brown noser that the teachers loved. I followed all the instructions. I loved getting all those certificates and putting them in those plastic sheets so that I could look how great and wonderful I was. And my life was kind of basic, I think, until my parents got divorced when I was around 8 years old. So we lived in this whole extended family system where I was around all of my family, and they decided to move to Uptown, and there was my first time that I was with a nuclear family. Now, I like that idea of just a nuclear family because that's what I saw on TV. TV, you see a mother, a father, and children. You don't see the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins, everybody in everybody's business. So I liked that concept. I have this thing that I have this picture in my head of how things should be. And if they're not that way, I'm going to try to force a solution of making it into that picture in my head. And so I guess that's having like expectations. So that means I qualify for Al-Anon and resentment. Oh, I need some water. So when my parents, and I lived in this, you know, nuclear family setting for a little bit, I was happy as can be because that picture was accurate in my head. Well, my mom started fooling around with the local butcher, and so she left my dad, and me and my siblings lived with my dad, and he got a new girlfriend. And then that didn't really work out so well, so my dad and the girlfriend moved out of the apartment, and in moved my mom and the butcher. So that apartment must be, you know, rent control or something, because they never gave up the apartment. They just let the families move in and out. And that's when I had my first resentment. My first resentment was towards my mom, because she did not fit that image that I had in my head of what a mom is supposed to be. You know, she started being really cool. She was a teen mom, and, you know, she wore bell bottoms, and she wore those bandanas, and she had like an afro. And I wanted her to be like the people on TV, like with an apron and making cookies. And she made brownies, but they had marijuana in them. So my mom was like super cool. She sold loose joints in the neighborhood. You know, I did not like that. I was a goody two-shoes. She didn't fit in with my picture of a mom. And so I had my first resentment towards her and held it on to like, I think, let me see, I'm 60. It was like 49 when I released that resentment through the help of Al-Anon. I mean, thankfully, before she passed away, I was able to have a relationship with her and accept her as the woman that she was, a teen mom with no resources, no information. And I started looking at the similarities and not the differences. And I saw her as another woman. And because of this program, I was able to release that resentment. I held my dad in a big pedestal, and I thought he was great and wonderful until I got older and wiser and saw that he played a part too, but it just wasn't my mom's. So in school, great student, super active. I was the first person in my family to go to college, and I joined everything. I've always been really busy, you know, never shy. And I was on the track team, the cross-country team. I became the resident assistant because I wanted to be in charge, have a key, and I give all the instructions to everyone. You know, I like having control. I like to fix people. I have an internal fix-o-meter, and I know what you need for me to fix, even though you're not aware of it. But I am aware, and I'm going to help you. And then somehow, you're going to thank me. So I go to college, I'm really busy, I get into the helping profession, and in an Easter break, I hang out with the local thug of my neighborhood. You know, like the Tony Montana of the neighborhood. Now, I'm the goody two-shoes of the family. I'm away at college. What am I doing with this guy? Well, I'm going to make him a better man. I mean, he smells good. When he's in the car, he snaps his finger to the music in just a sexy kind of way. He's charming, charismatic. Like, who gives a care if he's the drug dealer and the police are looking for him for attempted murder? I was going to fix him. So, you know, I planned the perfect wedding because I'm a perfectionist. And let me go back to one little thing here. When my parents got divorced and we lived with the dad and then the mom and the butcher, then we finally went to live with my grandmother. And my grandmother's untreated Al-Anon, big time codependent. That house was the Maldonado Hotel. Everybody came in and out. Someone was coming from Puerto Rico, they were going to land there. We're going to help them out. Someone came from the Army. They're going to come there. I'm going to give up our bedroom. You know, I liked it because I'm social. My sister didn't like it so much, so she had to give up her bedroom. So there, because of the chaos, I felt like I needed to be safe and in control because all these people coming in and out, and, you know, I wasn't aware of the drinking, but when my grandfather took the machete to try to kill the butcher, like, that was alcoholism. And when my uncle chased my 11-year-old brother with a knife, and we're trying to all put the toothbrush in the lock of the bathroom so he don't get in, that was alcoholism. It was nothing about a beer, but the behaviors were crazy, right? So in order for me to cope with that, I began a system of matchy-matchy. And matchy-matchy is like my bandana had to match my earrings, that had to match my rings, that had to match a bracelet, that had to match my speaker thing, you know, like today. Everything is red and black. And when I was 8 and 9, I did that so that I could feel safe and secure. Today I do it because, you know, I like matching. It's nothing about feeling safe and secure. So that trend of perfectionism went to my wedding. Everything had to match. I had a band, I had a DJ, everything was fabulous. All my friends from college were there. There was just one little problem. And when I was going down the aisle, the police swarmed in to Astoria Plaza in Queens and arrested my husband-to-be. Now, I'm an untreated Al-Anon, right? And I'm saying, well, the band is paid for. The people are here. I'm all dressed up. We're just missing a groom. So in the state of New York, you can get married by proxy. So I walked down the aisle with my dad, and I married my brother-in-law. Now that is the disease of perception. That is denial. That is distorted thinking. That was pre-Al-Anon. I didn't know I have a choice. I figured, you know, my picture said we were going to have this wedding, we were going to go to this apartment, and I was going to make that picture happen. Now, the minister said to me, "Emma Linda, really, if we don't mail these papers in, you won't be really married." Now, I didn't have a higher power then. I didn't know that, you know, those were red flags. And I should have paid attention. And I said, "Oh no, stand by your man." Because when I did my fourth and fifth step, I realized that I'm loyal to a fault. I realized that I had told myself, "I'm never going to get divorced. I'm going to be the best mom ever. I'm going to be there for that person." And so I just married him. So that first night, I'm crying myself to sleep, and he's in jail somewhere. And the next day, in the front page of the New York Post, you see a groom in handcuffs and a head down. Boy. So, you know, I had an opportunity to get out of that marriage, but I stayed. And we went to a couple of court hearings, and then we jumped bail, and that's how I got to Hawaii. So we won the land for 2 years. And, you know, we were in Hawaii for 2 years, and then he said, I want to go to Puerto Rico and open up a nightclub, and I'm like, all right. So we go to Puerto Rico, we open up a nightclub, and I have twin boys, 4 months old, and my house is surrounded by the FBI. So he gets arrested because my brother, who's a heroin addict, it says, if your arrest, if your tip can lead to an arrest, you will get $500. So my brother got $500 and my husband got 20 years to life. Second opportunity for me to leave that husband. I'm still loyal to a fault. I'm in denial. And I'm going to stand by my man. And, you know, maybe there'll be some hearings and some appeals. And so for the next 4 years, I proceed to manage the nightclub in Old San Juan. I manage a nonprofit organization for parents of twins. I fly to New York once a month with my twins and rent a car and drive up to the penitentiary where my kids are dressed in Oshkosh and I'm matchy-matchy and I don't belong in that place. We have conjugal visits like if nothing had happened. We're just one happy family for 4 years. I didn't have the courage to leave that marriage, so I had an overlapping relationship. And overlapping always sounds so much better than an extramarital affair. So he was a family friend, and he was married, and I was married, but I did a whole bunch of jading. I justified, I argued, I defend, I explained. My husband is in prison, so I'm technically separated. And he was the person that brought me into Al-Anon. So I get divorced, and we moved from Puerto Rico to North Carolina, but before moving to North Carolina, he and I were at like this long distance thing, you know, because he was still married technically, and I was still married technically. And I said, I don't like all this back and forth and traveling and calls and stuff like that. So I was looking at a wedding book, and there's a pink and peach cummerbund. Which color would you like? And he picked peach, and it was a shotgun wedding, and I had the shotgun. I decided that we were not going to have this long distance relationship anymore. And so he got divorced April 4th, I got divorced April 7th, and we got married April 29th. Now, you know, my fixometer came out with there too, but he was taller than starter husband number one. And he was charming. And he smelled good. And besides snapping his fingers, he danced salsa. So that was what I was concerned. I didn't think about, is he respectful and truthful, honest, and reliable, has integrity? None of those things. I was the charm of an alcoholic. alcoholic. But I didn't really know he was an alcoholic because he doesn't drink every day. It was just like a periodic drinker. And I thought drinkers are the people in Skid Row that hold their beers in a paper bag. Not this guy so nice and groomed and in a military uniform. So we get married, we move from Puerto Rico, we go to North Carolina. I have a child, a daughter, and I'm trying to figure out why he is the way he is. And my pixel-meter is activated. Forget that I need fixing. No way, that did not cross my mind at all. And so I'm thinking, gosh, is it because it's a blended family? Is it because, you know, we're young and ignorant? Is it because he had two boys, I had two boys and we have a girl? And then I had an internship at mental health and I came across those 20 questions. Eureka! This is it! I come home, you are an alcoholic. You qualify for all of these questions. And we go to counseling, and I am trying to figure out, what is he up to? Why is he so dishonest? Why, you know, just a simple thing. Did you mail the check? Yes, I mailed it. And then I find it in the car. Like, anything that you could just be truthful about, so dishonest. Emotionally unavailable, a workaholic, enmeshed with the children rather than me because he couldn't be emotionally connected to me. And so that craziness of me being unable to fix him and make him the husband that I had in my head because I had that image. We were all going to sit by the dining room table and sway and sing Kumbaya. But it wasn't like that. He was irritable, discontent, and we were all walking on needles and pins. And so I wasn't able to fix him, so then I got into fixing my house and my kids. And I color-coded everything. I went back to 8 years old and matchy-matchy. So I had three kids. My daughter was pink. The other son was blue. And the other one was green. I had green towels, green blankets, and cups, and toothbrushes. Anything was out of place, I knew who it belonged to. They had bicycle parking spots because I took electrical tape and taped parking spots in the garage. And everybody's bike better be in their parking spot. And I'd come home from work, and it was like, B-5-4-1. I scanned the house. What was out of place? Did you do CHP? Chores, homework, and piano. I mean, I had an acronym for everything. I had a dry checklist, what you should do when you first wake up. They couldn't read, but you see the little picture. Make the bed. Brush your teeth. Comb your hair. It was like, I had like little robots there. I couldn't help myself because I couldn't control my husband, so I was going to control the environment. I looked through his suitcase, through his briefcase. I looked through his pocket. I knew I was going to find out something. I was going to be the detective, and I'll find something, and then finally I could leave him because I have the evidence. So I go to Radio Shack, and I buy this device. And you put the device underneath your bed, and you connect it to the jack, and you could hear every conversation. So I come from work for lunch, remove the tape, put in a new tape, and listen to everything that happened while I was at work. Well, I never busted my husband, but I did bust my junior high school son trying to get $10 of marijuana in quarters. He asked a drug dealer, "Do you take quarters?" So that's how I found out my son was doing pot. Now, I was so fearful because I didn't want him to be a drug addict like my brother, and I didn't want him to go to prison like his father. So I enrolled him in the Betty Ford program. I mean, way over the top, because my fear, I was so fearful that that was going to happen. And he'd come home and he's like, you know, with his Argyle little sweater, and he's like such a dweeb. "Mom, there are people there from juvenile hall." "I'm not like that." I'm like, "I don't care. You're going to that 10-week program." Because of my fear. I did plenty of crazy things, like looking out for my husband at the downtown Palm Springs and finding his car and moving it so that when he comes out from whatever he's at, he'll think the car is stolen. I go to parties in LA, he'd get drunk, I'd leave him there. And I'd drive all the way to Palm Springs. I didn't care. Like, he'd do something, and it was like tit for tat. I was such a scorekeeper. And I was always a goody two shoes, followed the rules, was a nice girl. But, like it says in Understanding Ourselves, sooner or later, the alcoholic's behavior makes other people angry. As we realize that the alcoholic is telling lies, using us, and not taking care of responsibilities, we may begin to feel that the alcoholic doesn't love us. He often wants to strike back, punish, and make the alcoholic pay for the hurt and frustration caused by the uncontrolled drinking. This is our anger. This nice, sweet girl became a domestic violent person. I had a four-poster bed, and I would remove one of those posts and start hitting him at 2 o'clock in the morning when he came smelling like a girl, you know, perfume and alcohol. One time, I punched him in the mouth, and his front tooth came out. Like, it loosened. I did Jay for that. I was like, "You went to the dentist and you got some porcelain things. You should thank me for that." You know, like I became this angry person because I couldn't control him. So that's how my life was. Was that 20 minutes? How I got to Al-Anon. So I came in 1997 because things were crazy, right? I had Radio Shack, I have the color-coded kids, I'm crazy at work, nothing is perfect. I'm thinking I'm perfect, it's all these other people. So a professional tells me to go to Al-Anon. I go to Al-Anon, I cry that day, I hardly ever cry. I cry that day, I bought a couple of books, I figured, I'm smart. I got a couple of initials after my name. I'm going to read these books, highlight them a little bit, leave them open so you can read them. And I didn't come back for a whole year. I needed to get crazier. Just crazier. And I remember one time I found that my former husband had forged a loan. And it was my name, and I found it, and I yelled at the top of my lungs, I mean, "Get out!" And I, and the kids were all playing basketball, and they always say, "Mom, remember the day you went crazy?" Yes! You know, again, the deceptions, the lies, it was crazy making for me. I was crazy. So I went to Al-Anon, and when I came back, I said, "Okay, I'm going to follow everything that they say." They said, "Get a sponsor." That first meeting, I asked this woman, "Do you have a sponsor?" "Yeah." "Can I have her name and number?" You know, I was going to do it right this time. And The sponsor lives in Yucca Valley. I'm down in Palm Springs. That's like 40 minutes away, but she was near my job. She was the perfect sponsor for me. She was the cuddly, overweight mom that I always wanted. She had an apron. She made cookies. I'd go visit her during lunch. I'd cry. She'd hold me. It was the most nurturing, loving relationship. My first sponsor. Never even had met her. That girl gave me her name and number. And she suggested I get a sponsor closer to Palm Springs, and I did. And I also, it says be of service. So I'm from New York, and I'm an opportunist, and I'm going to pick the literature person. Because at that time, you have this big blue bucket of all the books, and you take it home, and then you bring it back the next Sunday. So I don't have to buy all those books and spend all that money that you guys spent. I'm just going to read all those books and bring back the books every Sunday. So I was of service. They had skits, and I was Bubbles, and I got to be with other people. Like, growing up, I always compared myself to other people, and I was never good enough, smart enough, white enough. I always compare myself to white people. They were smarter. They were, you know, there's no alcoholics in their family. Everything's fine. And then I come to Alamon, I'm like, holy crap, these people are messed up too, and they're white. So it was so wonderful to be like in a place where color didn't matter, that we were all affected by alcoholism, and they like understood me, and I understood them, and I felt loved in the rooms. I remember signing up for the fourth set workshop in Santa Barbara, and you know, because of my perfectionism, I wanted it to be tight, 14-point aerial with columns. And because I couldn't do it perfectly, I never started. So I figured I had to sign up and pay money to go to this fourth step workshop. And I took my husband's inventory first, because I have the fixometer and I'm the assessor. And then I took my inventory. But that first event, oh my gosh, the whole day was just full of love. I felt so much love. And that night, I think it was like, I don't know, Betty Baker's from Bakersfield. Who was that? A whole bunch of Burbank! Yes! And I'm going around, and I'm like, oh my God, where are my people? My people. And she was there stocking up the hospitality room. It was just like, I just felt so loved and accepted in the rooms of Al-Anon. And that's why I'm so thrilled to be here today, because you guys are my family. So, you know, Al-Anon did not save my marriage, and it took a long time for me to get it. I'm still, you know, I am not a slow learner, but I'm a quick forgetter. And I forget that I am not God. I forget about the third step, you know, self-sufficient and reliant. And that's why I had to keep coming back to Al-Anon. So the first 5 years, at least, I was like, and he said this, and he said that, and he. And everybody was so like, Melinda, he's coming back. You'll be okay. And I became secretary one time, and I switched cars with one of my teenage sons, and when I got there, I didn't have the bag with all the stuff, and they loved me anyway, and they just did the meeting. I mean, I would have been in trouble if that happened in my house. And you guys loved and accepted me. And you know, Puerto Ricans, they wear like loud colors. One time I came in with lime green shoes, and no one said a peep. Everybody loved me. So I just felt like the love of Al-Anon. Now, I tried so hard to save that marriage. I left no rocks unturned. I wanted this so bad. But Al-Anon did not save my marriage. And unfortunately, we had a bitter child custody dispute. And it did not matter that I worked in family law as a court expert, because alcoholism beat my ass. And my daughter went to live with him. She hated me, didn't want to have anything to do with me, uninvited me to her high school graduation, threatened me with a restraining order. I lost my daughter in the midst of this divorce. And, you know, I got divorced loving him and him loving me. And all my kids were like, what happened? Like, they couldn't understand it because they couldn't see the active drinking. It was all the isms. He was an adult child of an alcoholic too. And he was not capable of being rigorously honest. And when I realized that, that just broke my heart. You know, we got divorced, and I still came back for some more. I dated him for a whole year, thinking he'll change, you know. And I wanted him to see the light. And the person that needed to see the light was me. And that was a big grieving point for me, because I lost the dream that I had, and that loss of the dream and my daughter. And so what did I do? I kept coming to Al-Anon, and people say, keep your side of the street clean, keep going to meetings, pray for her. I remember surrendering, getting on my knees, handing her to God in a pink blanket and saying, God, you take care of her. There's nothing I can do. And today, she calls me, I'm her person. And she calls me every day. And I just helped her plan her big wedding. And she understood that it was the disease of alcoholism that separated us. And I never gave up hope, because the women before me that were here encouraged me not to give up hope. Now, so I was not going to do that again. I divorced the smelling guy, started husband number one. I divorced the alcoholic charming salsa dancing number two. There's just no way I'm going to pick anybody else, because my picker is off. So what do? I get into eHarmony and I let the computer pick for me. So we are compatible in so many things, but he doesn't wear cologne. And he has no rhythm and can't snap his fingers. He doesn't dance salsa. He got no style. He wears Tommy Bahama shirts and round-toe shoes. I mean, and so he's not the edgy kind of guy that I like, but the computer said we're compatible. So I meet him. My fixal media comes out. And, you know, in Al-Anon it says, take what you like and leave the rest. And I say, take what you like and fix the rest. So I go to fixing him. I don't like those faces in your teeth. You need braces. And he gets braces. I don't like those big bottle tooth glasses. So he gets contact lenses. And we're dating. I'm 45. I don't want to get pregnant. You'll need to have a vasectomy. And he gets a vasectomy. Now, I think somewhere in the AA book it says that people go through all lengths to get recovery. That guy went to all lengths to get a date with me, you know, to keep me. And so after 2 years of me saying, you know, he's just so nice. He doesn't curse. When he says he comes at 6, he comes at 6. Like, he's so dependable. And it was foreign to me. It just felt boring. Like, there was no Radio Shack devices. There was no chasing. There was no drama. There was just serenity. And I was not comfortable with that. I was not familiar with that. I don't know if I could have a marriage like that. And so I dated him for 2 years because I didn't trust myself that I was going to make you know, the right decision. So after 2 years and interviewing his 9 brothers and sisters and his ex-wives, I decided, okay, he's a keeper. And so this May, it will be 16 years of marriage. And that poor guy, you know, I even made him, before we got married, I said, you need to go get a colonoscopy and a clean bill of health. Because I'm not going to be taking care of anybody. So he's 45, you get a colonoscopy at 50. So he goes at 45 and the doctor says, you don't need to get a colonoscopy, it's just at 50. Oh, my girlfriend wants me to clean bill of health. And so then I married him. He complied with all of the things. Now, just a couple of years ago, he got diabetes. But me, I had shoulder surgery, knee problems, a retina detachment, so many medical issues. But not him. And there I was saying, you know, I'm not going to be taking care of you. So this guy, I'm making living amends to this guy because he is the kindest, most accepting guy ever. So nice. And, you know, my obsession with other people is so big because it keeps me busy and not looking at myself. And even though I let go of these alcoholics, I find somebody else to fix. Co-workers, neighbors, family members. You know, when I first went to Al-Anon, I think it was like the second week, I had a white minivan, and I brought my sister, my cousin, and two neighbors. Now, I didn't understand the 12 step. It says, after having a spiritual awakening, after doing the steps, then you try to carry the message. Well, I was carrying the message because I was an Al-Anon cheerleader without identifying what the message is. So for me, today, I have a God in my life, and it's not me. And you know the difference between me and God? God never thinks he's a Melinda. And so I'm the problem, and God is the solution. I came here to fix him. And what I discovered is that I needed fixing, that I needed to keep my eyes on myself. And alcoholism affected me in a way that all my focus was with other people. And now in Al-Anon, I'm fighting myself. I just retired in December, and I live in a 55 and older community, and oh my God, it's like summer camp for seniors. I am loving it, and I keep telling myself, do not ignite that fixometer. I know there are lots of people that can use my help, and but I'm going to be friendly and not friends. And I have this thing that I call it my toot toot book. Like, toot toot, I toot my own horn, and I write down in here every time I set a boundary. Oh, look, I have courage, I set a boundary. Toot toot. I said no to babysitting because I want to stay home this weekend. Toot toot. My parent, my son and his wife are having marital problems. Zip your lip, Melinda. Toot toot. The neighbor needs some resources. Did she ask for my help? Toot toot. I need to do this. I need to do that. I need to do this. First things first. Toot toot. So now I'm not dependent on everyone's approval. I'm tooting my own horn for the things that I'm learning here in Al-Anon. And, you know, I have an Achilles heel of that I'm powerless. But I remember when I come back to these meetings, there's a God that's greater than me, and all I have to do is turn it over. And every morning I wake up and I say the third step prayer, and then I'm on my way. I journal, I do this thing, you know, they have this thing in the daily checklist of yourself. How am I doing? And I do my 10-step when I journal. I'm a big journaler. And the main thing that I'm working about is, you know, did I not use my fixometer? If I do that, I'm good. Did I mind my business? Did anyone ask me? If they don't ask me, don't ask, no tell. And so if I'm doing that, I'm doing pretty damn good. And that's why after 23 years of Al-Anon, I keep coming every day to meetings through Zoom, face-to-face, conventions. I love this convention because every time I come, I continue to change and grow and live my best life. So I am happy, joyous, and free, and thank you for letting me share.